This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an Audio Journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Chan Medical School. Our program today will bring you articles from a variety of sources, including the New York Times Science Section, the New Yorker Magazine, the Smithsonian, the New Scientist, and the online periodical Science Daily. This is Tricia Droney, and today I will start with an article from the New York Times entitled, "The Wearable Data Your Doctor Actually Wants." This was written June 24, 2026, by Simar Bajaj. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has called wearable devices, like smartwatches or smart rings, a way for people to take control over their own health and a key to the Make America Healthy Again agenda. These devices, often called wearables, can provide a feed of useful data, including your step count, heart rate, sleep quality, and calories burned. In the last few years, surveys have found that about 40% of Americans were using some type of wearable and that ownership was higher among younger, healthier, and more fitness-minded consumers. "My vision is that every American is wearing a wearable within 4 years," Mr. Kennedy said in a congressional hearing last year. But many doctors are more skeptical, saying that only some of the metrics wearables provide are clinically useful, and they are still sorting out which ones and in what context. Dr. Zahi Fayed, director of the Biomedical Engineering and Imaging Institute at Mount Sinai, said the devices can help doctors remotely monitor patients and detect early signs of disease. But for now, he said, many wearable metrics fall short of medical standards, and there is little data to prove that using them improves health outcomes. Still, some patients searching for answers arrive at their doctor's offices with screenshots of their wearable data or questions about confusing readings. And some companies that sell wearables are starting to allow users to consult with clinicians through their apps. Certain wearables, like continuous glucose monitors, tend to be prescribed by doctors and are held to medical-grade standards. But with wearables you can buy online, doctors tend to focus on only a few metrics that are medically meaningful or revealing. For example, some wearable devices can flag atrial fibrillation, a potentially dangerous heart rhythm abnormality, said Dr. Erica Spatz, director of the Preventive Cardiovascular Health Program at Yale. In one Apple Watch study, researchers checked irregular pulse notifications against simultaneous readings from a medical-grade electrocardiogram patch and found that the watch alerts corresponded to atrial fibrillation 84% of the time. Other measures, like step counts, can show doctors how active or sedentary you are. Studies have tied getting about 7,000 steps a day to a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and dementia. Basic sleep patterns, when you go to bed, when you wake up, and how much total sleep you get, can similarly be useful, since both sleep consistency and duration are important, said Dr. Cherry Ma, a California-based sleep physician and adjunct lecturer at the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center. Researchers tested three popular wearables against a gold standard sleep study and found the devices agreed with the study over 90% of the time in distinguishing sleep from wakefulness. But some metrics like blood pressure, blood oxygen, and sleep stages are not measured accurately by wearables, Dr. Spatz said. Others, she added, like VO2 max and heart rate variability, can offer rough measures of fitness and recovery, but are not yet useful for making medical decisions. Many wearables also offer wellness scores aggregating multiple streams of data into a simple number, like biological age, stress, or sleep quality. Each company calculates these scores differently using their own proprietary algorithms, said Dr. Jag Singh, a professor at Harvard Medical School and a former chair of cardiology at Mass General Hospital. So doctors can't tell what these scores are really measuring or whether they correspond to actual health outcomes. They can be useful at the individual level for wellness, Dr. Singh said, but I don't think they're useful to the clinician. The best way to use wearables is to look at longer-term trends rather than obsessing over day-to-day swings, Dr. Fayed said. A sudden change can matter when it lines up with symptoms, like palpitations during a heart rate spike. But in general, one unusual reading is less telling than a sustained change over weeks or months. The value of the wearable is not the number, he said. It's the trajectory. The same caution, Dr. Singh said, applies when comparing your data with someone else's. People vary widely in metrics like heart rate variability or VO2 max, even when they have similar fitness levels. Your own baseline is typically more useful than any outside benchmark. If a wearable motivates you to improve your step count or helps you notice that alcohol worsens your resting heart rate, that can be useful, Dr. Fayed said. But if you compulsively check your data and become worried or frustrated, the wearable might be doing more harm than good. For example, wearables can sometimes worsen sleep, said Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, a health policy expert at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of the recently released book, Eat Your Ice Cream. One recent survey found that about 30% of the people who tracked their sleep were at risk of orthosomnia, an unhealthy fixation with getting perfect sleep. A better guide, Dr. Emanuel said, is how refreshed you feel in the morning. If anxiety over wearable data is a problem, one answer might be to just stop tracking the data. Another might be to use a wearable for specific short-term purposes, like increasing activity levels or sleep consistency, and then to put it away, Dr. Spat said. Wearables have made it easier than ever to monitor the inner workings of your body, but it will take more research and better tools to integrate those numbers, put them in context, and tell doctors what, if anything, is worth acting on. They help to tell a story, Dr. Spat said, but we haven't yet figured out how best to use them. Our next article was written by Chico Harlan of the New York Times on May 25th, 2026, is entitled 20 Years After His Film, Al Gore Tweaks the Climate Script. It was the world's most famous movie built around a slideshow, Al Gore in a darkened auditorium, clicking through images that warned of a heating planet. Within the film's first minutes, Mr. Gore described a moral imperative to make big changes, a call he echoed several times on stage. 20 years after the release of An Inconvenient Truth, his Oscar-winning documentary, it is remembered mostly for its cultural resonance, for bringing awareness of global warming into the mainstream. Mr. Gore and his intense focus on climate change energized both supporters on the left and critics on the right. In a self-effacing bit on Saturday Night Live, Mr. Gore warned viewers about glaciers on the attack. A year later, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize. As the years pass, Mr. Gore has kept going with his slideshow, giving presentations in hundreds of cities worldwide, most recently in Nashville earlier this month. And with time, the slideshow has changed in ways that reflect how the conversation about climate change has shifted over the course of a generation. On stage in Nashville, Mr. Gore made a central argument that would have been inconceivable two decades ago. Rather than directly invoking morality, he led with economics. The cost of renewable energy has plunged. He talked about market forces and about the spectacular, unprecedented technology revolution, including low-cost solar panels and wind turbines that now make aiding the planet an affordable choice. We're in a different world now, Mr. Gore said in Nashville. The options are terrific. The moral aspect of climate advocacy has had a long legacy, burnished not only by Mr. Gore, but also by Pope Francis, who portrayed a link between the environmental degradation and societal rot. In the late 2010s, a wave of youth protesters argued that political leaders and corporations had a duty to safeguard the planet for future generations. But as that movement waned, some felt the moralizing had at times brought a political backlash. After the documentary's release, Mr. Gore was criticized in some right-wing circles for hypocrisy, given that he traveled widely and lived a lifestyle reliant on fossil fuels for energy. Later, to attend climate events, the activist Greta Thunberg twice crossed the Atlantic by sailboat in a conspicuous effort to avoid polluting air travel, a move that some critics called a publicity stunt out of reach for non-celebrities. Environmentalists, meantime, made a new case that wind and solar energy were becoming cheaper than fossil fuels. Bill McKibben, a founder of the campaign group 350.org, said climate advocates no longer had to fight against the force of economic gravity. "This is the place where we have the most leverage," he said. "Instead of having the economic wind forever blowing at us, now it is in our sails. We do finally have a tool to work with." Johan Rockström, the scientist who leads the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, went so far as to say that the winning argument in pushing for cuts to greenhouse gas emissions is not the ethical and moral one, it is the economic one, in part because of the political blowback the moral argument can attract. In an interview, Mr. Gore spoke at length about his evolving slideshow, which he estimated he had given thousands of times. Did he move away from the moral message? "It remains the central argument," Mr. Gore said, pointing out that he was still making this case in speeches and at meetings. But he also noted that experience says there are a lot of people who will be more easily persuaded by the impact on their pocketbooks. He described his target audience as people whose minds are changeable, and that's where he thinks an economic argument, as well as one about health implications, has grown more effective. He also reasoned that the moral case, as strong as he felt it was, had perhaps reached its persuasive limits. President Trump has forcefully rejected the idea that renewable energy has an economic advantage, last year calling green energy a scam and describing climate change as the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world. During his first term, Mr. Trump criticized prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse, with Ms. Thunberg, the climate campaigner, in the audience. The consequences of climate change, of course, still raise moral questions. Wealthy countries are responsible for the bulk of emissions, while poorer nations disproportionately face the damage. Deadly heat waves singe countries where most can't afford air conditioning, while hurricanes barrel into small islands and slice their GDPs. Last year, the top United Nations court ruled that nations had a duty to prevent environmental harm and that any breach constituted a wrongful act. The idea that there is one way to talk about climate, it never was true, and it isn't true now, said Rachel Cletus, a senior policy director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mr. Gore still begins his slideshow, as he did in An Inconvenient Truth days, with an image of Earth taken during the Apollo 8 mission in 1968. After that, the differences in content are immediately apparent. Back then, though he cited examples of how climate change was driving extreme events, he said the phenomenon was just beginning to show itself. Now, he devotes a full hour to current events such as fast intensifying hurricanes, wildfires, and shrinking glaciers that are reducing water supply. In the 2006 documentary, he noted that the 10 hottest years on record have come over the previous 14 years, since the 1990s. Compare that with his current slideshow, in which he notes that the 10 hottest years have all happened since 2015. "It's still getting worse much faster than the solutions are being deployed," Mr. Gore said in the interview. Mr. Gore said he had been presenting some version of the slideshow since the 1980s and had performed it more than 1,000 times even before the documentary's release, using a Kodak carousel projector in the early days. He said that one of the most important presentations was on the deck of a houseboat in Center Hill Lake in his home state, Tennessee. He was with longtime friends with beer flowing. They weren't the most obvious audience for a climate talk, but he said they were interested. "It emboldened me to start taking it on the road in a much more forceful way," Mr. Gore said. A scene in the documentary showed him at a desk, laptop open, jotting notes on paper. I guess the thing I've spent more time on than anything else is trying to identify all those things in people's minds that serve as obstacles to them understanding this, Mr. Gore said at the time. Asked why he continued with the slideshow 20 years later, he described it as a challenge of a particular kind. But this time he was talking about himself, not the planet. It's one of those when you pick it up, you just can't put it down, he said. Next, we have an article entitled, By September, Nearly a Third of Americans Will Live in States with Legal Aid in Dying. This article was written June 1st, 2026 by Paula Spann. Jules Netherland traveled from her home in the Bronx to the New York State Capitol in Albany several times in the past few years, hoping to persuade the legislature to pass a medical aid in dying bill, allowing terminally ill patients to end their lives with a lethal prescription. She spoke at rallies with other members of the advocacy organization Compassion and Choices. She visited legislators' offices. In 2024, as a state assembly was debating the aid in dying bill, she helped unfurl a banner in the chamber gallery that read, Stop the Suffering. Her activism was becoming difficult. Miss Netherland, who is 59 and works for a nonprofit, was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2019. I did a full year of aggressive treatment, she said, chemotherapy, a mastectomy, radiation treatment every weekday for 5 weeks, 6 months of 2 oral medications. She recovered and felt well until the cancer returned a few years later. Although metastatic breast cancer is incurable, drugs are keeping her disease at bay for now. Miss Netherland feels fortunate but also fatigued, and she contends with brain fog, GI symptoms, and joint pain. My energy is really limited, she said. As she emailed and called legislators, Ms. Netherland feared she might die before the aid in dying bill, first introduced in New York in 2016, could become law. On June 9, 2025, after the assembly approved the bill, Ms. Netherland was in the state Senate chamber, watching the AI votes mount and seeing it pass. Governor Kathy Hochul signed an amended version in February. It is scheduled to take effect August 5th. A similar law is slated to take effect in September in Illinois, which would become the 13th state, plus the District of Columbia, where medical aid in dying is legal. A breakthrough moment, said Kevin Diaz, president of Compassion and Choices, which has spearheaded the long campaign for such laws. After almost 30 years, Oregon's law, the first in the country, was enacted in 1997. The addition of two populous states means that almost a third of Americans will live in one where medical aid in dying is legally available. It shows that there's broad support for this model, Mr. Diaz said. Polls consistently back that claim. A Pew Research Center survey last spring found that almost two-thirds of respondents didn't consider the practice morally wrong, either because they thought it was acceptable or not a moral issue. Support crossed many political and religious lines. A narrow majority of Republicans and 76% of Democrats both found physician-assisted death, also sometimes called physician-assisted suicide, permissible. So did most Catholics, Jews, and non-evangelical white Protestants. In New York, a Siena poll found that 54% of respondents supported aid in dying, including majorities of men and women of all age groups and of city, suburban, and upstate residents. A plurality of Latinos supported it. Black respondents narrowly opposed it. Passing these laws has grown somewhat easier, said Thaddeus Pope, a bioethicist and professor at Michel Hamline School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, who tracks such policies. You can say, we have 10 years in California, 18 years in Washington, and 29 years in Oregon, and nothing bad has happened. It becomes more accepted. Yet legalizing medical aid in dying, or MAID, M-A-I-D, has been and remains a long, contentious process. Catholic leadership and many disability organizations staunchly oppose it. Pope Leo personally asked Illinois' Governor Pritzker not to sign the bill. The American Medical Association says that physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer and poses serious societal risks, although a number of state medical organizations have opted to remain neutral or, as in New York, to support passage. The Patients' Rights Action Fund, through a sister organization, has lawsuits pending or on appeal in California, Delaware, and Colorado, arguing that aid in dying laws discriminate against people with disabilities by steering them towards physician-assisted death instead of treatment. Is a litigation strategy we've developed to ultimately get to the Supreme Court, says Matt Valliere, the group's executive director, who declined to say whether it would sue to block the Illinois and New York laws. Even when aid in dying laws succeed, using them can prove challenging. In every state, except Montana, where it became legal through a court decision, so there is no statute governing eligibility, aid in dying is available only to people with incurable illnesses who are expected to die within 6 months. It typically involves oral and written requests to two doctors, with mandated waiting periods between requests. Patients must have the mental capacity to make the decision, which disqualifies those with dementia, and they must ingest the medication without assistance. An amendment Governor Hochul insisted on adds a psychological or psychiatrist to the process. All but two states require patients to be residents. Oregon and Vermont scrapped their residency requirements to settle lawsuits brought by Compassion and Choices. Courts ruled against a similar suit in New Jersey. Moreover, any doctor, hospital, or healthcare system can legally decline to provide aid in dying, and religiously affiliated institutions often opt out. Those that participate can add their own requirements. The state can say you need A, B, and C, and Columbia Presbyterian can say we also want D, E, and F, Dr. Pope said. Perhaps these restrictions or a lack of public awareness help explain why, despite the headlines and fervent debates, the number of people who actually use the law is tiny in every state, usually 1% or fewer of the deaths recorded annually. The support for giving patients this kind of autonomy at the end of life remains widespread, but the desire to personally exercise it is apparently not. Still, after studies showed that many patients seeking MAID were dying before they could complete the process, the trend has been to loosen restrictions. California cut its 15-day waiting period to 48 hours. New Mexico allows physician assistants and advanced practice nurses to write prescriptions along with doctors. Most states have now amended their laws two or three times, Dr. Pope said. We have liberalized. Telehealth can also facilitate access to participating doctors. Compassion and Choices is planning legal challenges to end residency requirements in additional states, Mr. Diaz said. It is also considering how to make inroads in jurisdictions with a much different cultural and political environment, he added, mentioning Florida and other southern states. Medical aid in dying represents a shift in power, Mr. Diaz said. The person who has to bear the burden of the suffering should have the ability to decide when it's enough, he added. Anne Gurnett Bander, 72, a retired research scientist in Carmel, New York, cared for her husband for 4 years as he had ALS, the relentlessly disabling neurological disorder, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, rendered him bedridden and dependent on feeding and breathing tubes. By the time he died, the only thing he could do was nod his head, she recalled. So being diagnosed with ALS herself last year was my worst possible nightmare, Dr. Gurnett Bander said. She was planning to fly to Switzerland, where the nonprofit organization Dignitas provides medical aid in dying, when she learned about the New York bill and began speaking publicly in support of it, her voice faltering as her illness advanced. Dr. Gurnett Bander and Ms. Netherland say they're not certain they'll use lethal drugs to end their lives as their symptoms intensify. Not infrequently, patients complete the necessary steps, secure the prescribed medication, decide they don't need it after all, and die of their diseases. But both women insist that the choice should be theirs. It can offer so much peace of mind, Ms. Netherland said. I thought people should have this option. Now they will.
Next, an article by Emily Anthes, written June 25th, 2026, from the New York Times, called "To Reveal the Rhythmic Roots of Laughter, Just Tickle an Ape." Humor is deeply personal. A punchline or a pratfall that leaves one person doubled over in delight might elicit blank stares from another. But laughter is universal, an innate instinct shared by humans everywhere. And not just humans. Chimps chuckle, gorillas guffaw, bonobos bust a gut. All the planet's great apes laugh, and they often do so in the same kind of regular, repeating rhythm that humans do, scientists found in a small new study. The research sheds light on how laughter evolved with and amongst great apes, becoming faster and more variable in humans than in these other primate species. While non-human apes appeared to laugh in ways that were largely fixed, humans were more flexible in their expressions of mirth, changing up the tempo of their chuckles depending on the circumstance, the scientists found. I think we can say we are the masters of laughter, said Chiara de Gregorio, a research fellow at the University of Warwick in Britain and an author of the study. We can have a small, polite laugh in front of the Queen of England, and then when we are in the pub with our friends and we laugh so much in a different way. We can even laugh in a way that communicates to the other person that we actually didn't find the joke they said funny. This wide-ranging repertoire requires significant vocal flexibility and control, the same skills that humans would have needed for spoken language. The study demonstrates the uniqueness of human laughter, said Greg Bryant, a cognitive science at the University of California, Los Angeles, who was not involved in the new research. It provides a window into human vocal evolution. In the new study, which was published in the journal Communications Biology, the researchers analyzed the recorded laughter of 4 children and 13 young captive apes, 4 orangutans, 2 gorillas, 3 bonobos, and 4 chimpanzees. Some of the recordings featured laughter produced during play, while others captured laughter elicited by tickling. Many of the recordings were initially created 2 decades ago by Marina Ross, a comparative psychologist at the University of Portsmouth in Britain and an author of the new study. I wasn't lucky enough to be there tickling baby gorillas at the time, Dr. De Gregorio said. During tickling, the scientists found all the species produced laughter that shared the same basic rhythmic characteristic. It was isochronous, meaning that each vocalization, each pant, hoot, or ha, occurred at regular, evenly spaced intervals, like the ticking of a clock or metronome. The scientists did not observe this same regularity in the laughter that humans or other apes produced during play, perhaps because the physical, rough-and-tumble nature of many of these play sessions disrupted regular breathing patterns. Though the laughter of humans and apes shared some basic rhythmic properties, the tempo or speed of these rhythms varied considerably between species. On average, humans had laughter that was quicker than that of other apes, and the species that were most closely related to humans, chimps and bonobos, laughed faster than those that were more distant relatives, gorillas and orangutans. Imagine, Dr. Gregorio said, a metronome that goes slower for orangutans, so like tick, 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 but faster, way faster in humans, so tick, 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 tick. Even though humans were the fastest laughers on average, they displayed enormous variability in their laugh speeds, laughing languidly in some circumstances and rapidly in others. They were also the only species to change the tempo of their laughter depending on the context, laughing faster, for instance, while being tickled than during play. The study had limitations. The subject pool was small, and the researchers analyzed just a handful of laughter's many characteristics. But future studies with larger sample sizes could help scientists learn more about how humans made it their own. Laughter is such an important part of our way of communication, Dr. Gregorio said. It's able to communicate way more than I'm playing and I'm having fun. A little older article written April 9th, 2026, but still relevant, was written by Matt Richtel. It's entitled How the Internet Became the Cookbook of the Drug Trade. On a warm night 3 summers ago, Kai Radin, a student at the University of Colorado Boulder, opened a package of orange-white powder that he had purchased through an encrypted site on the dark web. He had ordered Quaaludes, an illegal sedative, but he wasn't taking chances. He placed a sample on a fentanyl test strip, negative. Mr. Radin weighed out a gram using a digital scale that sat on the coffee table in his room at his fraternity. Grateful Dead posters decorated the walls. Delilah, his rat terrier, sat with him on the couch. With a rolled-up $50 peso bill, he inhaled the gram. Just tried the Ludes, and they are just as good as people say, he messaged a friend on social media. Holy hell, doses are $20. His girlfriend, Emma Buck, had been in the hallway on a call. She returned to find Mr. Radin pacing, an odd reaction, uncharacteristic of a sedative, she said. It wasn't a sedative. It was something new and unknown and part of an explosion of novel lab-made chemicals that is redefining the illicit drug market. In recent years, hundreds of ultra-potent drugs have emerged, often identified by health authorities and law enforcement only after they have shown up in the toxicology report of someone who has overdosed. Most of these substances originate in traditional medical research, in scientific papers and patents that were published by legitimate scientists and companies and then copied and modified by illicit chemists. This is the science-to-street pipeline, and it has come to dominate the illicit drug market. In his fraternity room that night, July 22, 2023, Mr. Radin started to feel sick. He took a cold shower, put on an anti-nausea bracelet, and lay with his head on Miss Buck's lap. The pair had fallen hard for each other that spring. He was a neuropharmacology major, fascinated by the brain. He was the most intellectually curious person I'd ever met, she said. She left after midnight. By then, she said, he was feeling better and had fallen asleep. The next day, when she couldn't reach him, she came to check on him. She found him in bed with Delilah perched on him. She thought he was asleep until she felt his cold body. Katie Becker, a morgue supervisor for Boulder County, assisted in the autopsy. She noticed foam around his lips, a telltale sign of overdose typically associated with fentanyl. The drug slows breathing and suppresses the gag reflex, causing fluid to build up in the air sacs, effectively drowning the user. But a toxicology exam found no fentanyl. There was nothing in the report that would explain the cause of death, Ms. Becker said. It was a mystery. The story of what happened to Mr. Radin and the detective story that followed is a chilling example of the intimate relationship between well-intended science and the creators of the world's most lethal drugs. By its end, the case would lead its scientific investigators unsettlingly close to their own doorstep. In 1971, President Richard Nixon began what became known as the War on Drugs. That year, 6,700 Americans died of overdose. In 2024, 80,000 did, an increase of nearly 70% from just a decade earlier. What has changed are the drugs. In the 1970s, the main targets, cocoa, poppies, marijuana, came from farms. Today, most illegal drugs are made in unregulated labs around the globe, from big enterprises in China and India to single-person operations run from anonymous apartments. The drugs include fentanyl, but it is just one of hundreds of synthetic, ever more potent compounds known as novel psychoactive substances. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime now lists 1,446 new psychoactive substances, up from 643 a decade ago. to refer to this trend as the digitization of drugs. Today, with the internet, virtually any esoteric molecular structure or chemistry study that is published online is instantly available to armchair chemists and illicit drug suppliers the world over. Dr. Laura Bone, an associate dean of research at the Morsani College of Medicine at the University of South Florida, who develops new opiate molecules for medical research, described the internet as the cookbook for the drug trade, offering thousands of papers, proceedings, and books with different molecules. It has also made the drug supply dangerously unpredictable. Compounds are now mixed, substituted, and adulterated almost continuously. A recent study from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, which tests illicit drugs from around the country, found that 42% of samples that contain fentanyl include five or more psychoactive compounds, from 23% 3 years ago. The supply is so reliably polluted that even careful users like Mr. Radin are operating blind. You have almost no chance of knowing what you've got, said Edward Sisko, a research chemist at NIST. For scientists, the new reality is all too clear. The best-intentioned research discovery, if published, could quickly give rise to the next deadly street drug. We had no idea these compounds would be used illicitly, said Alexandros Marikonis, a professor of medicinal chemistry at Northeastern University in Boston and director of the Center for Drug Discovery there. It didn't occur to us. There are countless examples. In 2001, Dr. Macrinus published his discovery of AM-2201, a lab-made molecule that mimicked properties of cannabis but with greater potency. The patent for AM-2201, a chemical name taken from Dr. Macrinus's initials, suggested that it might be used to develop a drug to treat pain, glaucoma, epilepsy, nausea, AIDS wasting, multiple sclerosis, and other potential ailments. A pain drug never materialized, but within several years, illicit drug makers had copied and manipulated AM-2201 to create the basis for an illegal, addictive, and sometimes deadly synthetic compound called spice. As novel drugs continue to emerge, well-intentioned scientists tried a new tactic to get ahead of the problem. They would try to predict what deadly drugs might emerge next. This is what drug experts call prophetic research. But as scientists are discovering, illicit drug makers can pirate this literature too. On October 19th of 2023, 3 months after Mr. Radin's death, samples of his blood and urine arrived for analysis at the Center for Forensic Science, Research and Education, a nonprofit forensics laboratory in Horsham, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia. The laboratory is tasked with identifying a rapidly growing assortment of new synthetic drugs that are further polluting the drug supply and causing widespread overdoses. In 2023, Mr. Radin's was one of 268 cases of unidentified novel drug substances handled by the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. This year, it is on pace to exceed 1,000. The center is run by Alex Kratulski, a forensic toxicologist and rising expert on novel psychoactive substances. Stocky and quick to smile, Dr. Kratulski fuels his day with energy drinks and coffee, spiked with Splenda. Colorful sculptures of skulls decorate his office, and paintings of skulls hang on the walls. "It's because I deal with death so much," he said, sitting at his desk one afternoon in the summer of 2024. When Mr. Radin's samples arrived, they were run through a high-resolution mass spectrometer, which finally measures the molecular weights of compounds as a first step toward identifying them. The compounds were then compared against a database of 1,200 known drug molecules, several times more molecules than a typical medical examiner can access. By November, the lab had found a match for the molecule that had killed Mr. Radin. N-desethyl etanazinate. "It is 10 times more potent than fentanyl," Dr. Kratulski wrote in an email to Ms. Becker, the Boulder pathologist. "We are just seeing this for the first time." By first time, Dr. Kratulski meant that they were seeing the compound on the streets for the first time, but he realized that he had encountered it previously in a paper written by a colleague not 2 years earlier. N-desethyletonatazine, the drug found in Mr. Radin, belongs to a family of synthetic opiates called nitazenes. This chemical group first caught Dr. Kratulski's attention in the spring of 2019, when he and other scientists on the leading edge of forensic toxicology learned about a fatality in Alberta, Canada. The cause was a nitazene variant called isotonazine. The same drug also showed up in deaths in the coming months in Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, among other places. These drugs appeared to be following a familiar pattern from lab to street. The nitazene drug family was developed in the late 50s by a Swiss pharmaceutical company, Ciba, whose scientists hoped they had found a new pain drug. But in early experiments, nitazenes dangerously suppressed breathing. So, like many pharmaceutical creations with unacceptable side effects, nitazenes all but disappeared, and the chemical structures and effects were hardly known beyond old German patents. Dr. Kratulski and his peers had a theory about why nitazenes were suddenly resurfacing in the drug supply. The U.S. and China had outlawed fentanyl, and illegal drug makers had gone looking for a replacement. Every time something happened to one compound, something new would come to take its place, Dr. Kratulski said. Then, in July of 2020, a second nitazene called metanizine showed up in the death in Ohio. The prospect that nitazenes were morphing was no longer theoretical. Oh no, Dr. Kratulski recalled thinking at the time, this is really happening. By this time, Dr. Kratulski had begun brainstorming with a small group of molecular detectives, which included academic researchers, officials in Europe, and forensics toxicologists at commercial companies. Could they reasonably predict what nitazene might appear next on the streets? By modeling the future, could they help police officials and hospitals to prepare and even save lives? Why do we wait until a 15-year-old kid dies or somebody overdoses, said Roy Girona, a forensics toxicologist at the University of California, who helps identify new drug compounds for the Drug Enforcement Administration and works independently of Dr. Kratulski's group. Christopher Stove, a toxicologist at the University of Ghent in Belgium, argued that this predictive work could help shorten the lifespan of dangerous new drugs by getting them declared illegal more quickly and perhaps discouraging their production. We are telling the drug producers, we already know about this compound, we already have the standards, it's already detectable, he said. We'd rather have the data before a compound is on the mass market. Among the influential prophetic scientists is István Ujvári, a Hungarian medicinal and pharmaceutical chemist who worked in agricultural pesticides in Hungary for decades before becoming obsessed 20 years ago with the rise of new synthetic drugs. The shelves of his home office in Budapest are packed with scientific journals, historical proceedings from conferences, and esoteric small-run chemistry books with such titles as Opiates and Characteristics and Functions of Opiates, and Neuropsychopharmacology. Dr. Ujvári scours these for compounds that could become threats. I look at a patent, he said. It could be 200 or 400 pages, with 50 to 200 individual compounds described. I look for the most active ones in the table, and I print it out, highlight, extract the two or five most active ones, look at the structures, and I present them at conferences. In 2020, shortly after the first nitazenes appeared, officials from the European Union Drugs Agency, which tracks the emergence of new molecules, asked Dr. Ujvári to help them write an in-depth paper exploring which nitazene substances might appear next. A top European authority sent an email to Dr. Ujvári asking him to provide a top-level review on some of the other new opiates we have seen or may see. Dr. Ujvári was aware that such predictions came with a risk. Street chemists could lift that research and use it to make a drug. The prophecy could spur the reality. It had happened before. In April 2013, Samuel Bannister, an accomplished medicinal chemist and expert in the rise of novel psychoactive substances, had published a paper in the journal ACS Chemical Neuroscience profiling a recently detected synthetic cannabinoid called AB-001 and several related molecules. He used his initials as codes for several of these, including two molecules, SBD-006 and 5FSDB-006. Several months later, customs agents in Finland seized drugs based on these molecules in a shipment from Hong Kong. Someone, somewhere in the world, had read our paper and replicated our work, Dr. Bannister said. He was scared and concerned at the time, he recalled. It's when I started wondering, what is the responsibility of scientists in all of this? In March of 2021, the brainstorming and predictive work on nitazenes was published in two independent but related papers. The articles would later haunt Dr. Krotulski as he reviewed Mr. Radin's toxicology report. The first paper by Dr. Ujvare and several top officials with the European Union Drugs Agency reviewed research dating back to the 1950s to consider various nitazene variants and ways that the molecules could be modified to create new ones that were more or less potent. In the paper, the authors argued that much of this information had already been published. If underground chemists were mining the literature, they already knew that what Dr. Ujvare and his colleagues had to say. Indeed, by this time, even newer nitazenes had begun appearing. In February of 2021, proto-nitazene, which is 15 times more potent than fentanyl, surfaced in Iowa and has since killed at least 200 people. Still another variant, which has 40 times more potent than fentanyl, surfaced in March of 2021 in West Virginia and has killed at least 100 people. The second paper in 2021, written by other scholars, including Dr. Stowe from the University of Ghent, looked at existing nitazene compounds, modeled hypothetical new ones, and explored how they interact with the opioid receptor in the brain. Not long after, some of the drugs mentioned in the two papers appeared on the street for the first time. In November 2022, N-desethanol isonitazene surfaced in a drug sample from Florida. It is 80 times more potent than fentanyl and has been detected in at least 40 fatal overdose doses, Dr. Krotulski said. Then in October 2023, another one emerged. It had been one of the hypothetical compounds mentioned in the second paper and was called N-desethyl etanitazine. But now it had been made real. It was the drug that killed Mr. Radin. Unlike many new illicit drugs, this one could not have been directly pirated from older scientists' literature. The original German patent had not discussed its potency and structure. That appeared to come with the 2021 prophetic paper, which, Mr. Krotulski said, put the compound on the map. Had the papers contributed in some way to the death of Mr. Radin? Were forensic toxicologists predicting the future, or were they creating it? In November of 2024, at a symposium in Philadelphia, Simon Elliott, a visiting professor in forensic toxicology at King's College in London, put the question directly to Dr. Ujvare, Dr. Krotulski, and Dr. Stowe. Is there a chance, Dr. Elliott asked, with chicken and egg, when you are proposing certain compounds that illicit chemists saw these and said, hey, you've done the hard work for us. We know now the chemistry. He continued, is there a chance you actually start the trend? The symposium, organized by Dr. Krotulski's lab, had brought together officials from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and U.S. Customs and Border Protections, as well as scientists from around the world. Over 3 days of presentations and panel discussions, they wrestled with where their new molecules were coming from, mostly scientific literature and patents, who was making them, labs in India, China, and Mexico, and how best to stop the spread, more chemists and resources. Dr. Krotulski was first to respond to Dr. Elliott's question. The reality is, yes, there's always a possibility, he said. Case by case, it was typically unclear where clandestine chemists found their ideas, he said. Nobody knows what's really coming next, he continued. So you can make the argument that having that information is more beneficial to us than not having information. Dr. Ujvare followed, If I can access the literature, then they can also find those structures, he said. The challenge, he added, was to not be one step behind, but one step ahead. Dr. Stove agreed. If we can think of it, others can think of it, he said. We're not that smart. In a more recent interview, Dr. Stove said he didn't know if the paper had played a role in the emergence of N-desethyl-etanazide. I'm not worried, entirely sure it would not have surfaced, he said, adding that the drug might have emerged anyway. In the audience in Philadelphia was Ms. Becker, the morgue supervisor who had assisted in the autopsy of Mr. Radin. Dr. Kortolska had invited her to present the case and the discovery of N-desethyl-etanitazine in his system. Later, she said she found it interesting that the effort to predict new nitazenes might have played a role in seeding them, but she appreciated the effort to stop the spread. We are all trying to stay ahead of it, she said. And we'll wind up today with a few questions and answers from a wonderful New York Times bestseller book called The Book of General Ignorance, Everything You Think You Know Is Wrong, by John Lloyd and John Mitchinson. First question today is, which African mammal kills more humans than any other? The answer, the hippopotamus. Unfortunately, hippos like to hang out near slow-moving fresh water bordered by grass, the same habitat favored by humans. Most accidents occur either because a submerged hippo has been inadvertently whacked on the head with a paddle and decides to overturn the boat, or because people are out walking at night, just the time when hippos leave the water to graze. Being trampled by a startled hippo is not a dignified way to die. Hippopotamuses, once believed to be members of the pig family, but now shown to be most closely related to whales, are divided into two species, common and pygmy. The common hippo is the third largest land animal after the African and Asian elephants. Not many animals are stupid enough to attack a hippo. They are very irritable beasts, especially when they have young. They dispose of lions by plunging them into deep water and drowning them, crocodiles by biting them in half, and sharks by dragging them out of the water and trampling them to death. However, they are strict vegetarians, so their aggression is mostly to do with self-defense. Hippos mainly eat grass. The skin of a hippopotamus weighs a ton. It is 1.5 inches thick, bulletproof as far as most guns are concerned, and accounts for 25% of the animal's weight. It exudes an oily red fluid that keeps it from drying out, which used to make people think that hippos sweat blood. Don't be fooled by their bulk. A fully grown hippo can easily outrun a man. Hippos are the only mammal other than whales and dolphins to mate and give birth underwater. They can close their nostrils, flatten their ears, and stay completely submerged for up to 5 minutes at a time. Hippos have appalling breath. When they appear to be yawning, they are in fact blasting everything around them with halitosis as a warning to stay clear. This is good advice. A hippo's tusks are sharp, and a snap of the jaws can easily sever a limb. Hippos have only 4 teeth, which are made of ivory. Part of George Washington's set of false teeth was made from hippopotamus ivory. According to the Oxford Companion to Food, the best part of a hippopotamus to eat is their breasts, pot roasted with herbs and spices. Failing that, the back muscles cooked in the same manner are acceptable. And our final question is, what's the bravest species of animal? The carrier pigeon, which has received more than half of all the Dickin medals for animal bravery ever issued. The medal was instituted by Mrs. Maria Dickin, founder of the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals, PDSA, in the United Kingdom in 1943. Between 1943 and 1949, the PDSA awarded 54 Dickin medals to 32 pigeons, 18 dogs, 3 horses, and 1 cat. Recently, a few more awards have been given out, but notably to 2 guide dogs that led their owners to safety down more than 70 floors in the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Messenger pigeons were used throughout World War II during communication blackouts and attacks. One of the first to win the DM was Winky, who was on a plane when it crashed. Winky broke free and found her way back to her owner in Scotland. From her oily and bedraggled appearance, Winky's owner could roughly estimate how long she'd been flying. Using this information along with the last known coordinates of the plane, the crew were saved. A few years later, a pigeon named Gustav was issued to the war correspondent Montague Taylor and braved a 150-mile trip to deliver the first account of the Normandy landings. Gustav came to a sticky end after the war when someone cleaning out his loft accidentally sat on him. In 1942, behavioral scientist B.F. Skinner came up with the idea of using trained pigeons to guide weapons. The system worked by training pigeons to earn a food reward by pecking at the image of a ship. Three of them were then placed in the nose of a missile. Once launched, the pigeons would see the ship in their window and peck at it, triggering a corrective mechanism linked to the missile's guidance system. The closer the ship got, the bigger it appeared in the screen, and the more the pigeons pecked, so that just before they hit the target and were obliterated, they were being showered with grain. The system worked well in simulations, but the Navy eventually balked at putting it into practice. The pigeon guidance technology work wasn't entirely wasted. For a while, the United States Coast Guard used pigeons to guide rescue helicopters. They were trained to peck at orange dots, which meant they could be used in searches for orange life jackets in open seas, their eyesight being 10 times sharper than that of the pilots. A quick reminder as we wind up that there are a variety of ways to listen to Audio Journal broadcasts. You can listen live. You can stream it from our website at audiojournal.org or on your phone through Zeno Media, which you can contact at 1-712-770-1043. You can also listen with cable TV. You can check our own list to find your town at audiojournal.org/listening with cable TV. There's a special receiver that's tuned to Audio Journal's frequency supplied at no cost to all of our listeners. Do you need one? Give us a call at 508-797-1117. Also, you can use your smart speaker and just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn, or hey, Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. You can use your smartphone. Find Audio Journal on the Zeno Radio app at apps.apple.com/us/app/Zeno Radio. Oh no, you missed your favorite program? Look for podcasts on our website at audiojournal.org, locally produced programs. You've been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. I'm Tricia Droney. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
This is Bird Note.
An evening baseball game isn't the only thing illuminated by the bright stadium lights. High in the air, countless flying insects are drawn to them. And those insects are a perfect snack for the game's avian attendees. Common nighthawks swoop with their wide mouths open to hoover up the flying insects under the lights, performing aerial stunts over the athletes on the ground. Common nighthawks belong to the nightjar family, a group of birds with long wings and big mouths that are adept at hunting in the air. Nighthawks have gray and brown feathers that help them blend in on the ground. In the sky, though, these birds stand out. Vertical white wing stripes glow bright even at dusk and dawn, when they're most active. To show off for potential mates, male nighthawks use a display called booming. They dive so that air makes a loud boom as it passes over their wings.
Hot dogs! Hot dogs!
The next time you're enjoying your snacks at the game, just know that the birds are enjoying theirs, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by 7-year-old Quinn Sedgley, who wants everyone to help birds and wildlife.